Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is a special presentation, an in-depth original investigative report on the JFK assassination. Today, we will be speaking with Vincent Palamara. Vincent Palamara is arguably one of the most knowledgeable people in the United States, according to the protocols that the Secret Service lives by and is supposed to enact, and its history. He has had over 80 individual investigations and interviews with special Secret Service agents, White House aides, and surviving members of the Kennedy family. We will be talking with him concerning why was there a stand-down order in Dallas to the local police that goes against all protocols in the history of the Secret Service. We will also ask about who had the power to do that. What was their rationale for doing that? There were many inconsistencies, including the number of police cars that are supposed to surround the president's limousine and who was supposed to have been in the limousine. You'll hear new information you have not heard before on today's program. Then, time permitting, we will also be speaking with someone that you have not heard from before either, St. John Hunt. He is the son of the high CIA spymaster and Watergate burglar, E. Howard Hunt. St. John Hunt was born in the United States, however lived on various continents while growing up due to his father's activities with the CIA. For the past 35 years, St. John has been involved with the music industry and also in the healthcare profession. Later, St. John reproduced the conversations with his father, in addition to new information about the JFK assassination and Watergate. We'll be asking about that because it was on his father's deathbed that his father confessed to his role in the JFK assassination. Let's begin with my guest, Vincent Palamara.
Oh, great to be here, Gary. Thanks to you and thanks to your audience.
Harry Truman once said that the only boss the President of the United States has is the Secret Service. There are strict rules not to be compromised for the protocol means by which the Secret Service protects the President. Please begin by detailing for us the agency's protocol for protecting the President in public and going clear back, especially in the 1960s when Kennedy was President. And what should have been the proper protocol, for example, protecting multi-story buildings? And then review us with us the changes in the standard rules that were made on November 22, 1963, when Kennedy's motorcade drove through Dallas.
Okay. Yeah, one needs to look no further back than the previous trip to Florida, which was 4 days before. And that was a model of great security in comparison to Dallas. Agents were riding on the rear of the limousine. That did not happen in Dallas. The military aide rode in his traditional position between the driver and the agent in charge. And yet in Dallas, for the first time, he was asked by the Secret Service not to ride there. The cars were going very fast in Tampa. I got this from several witnesses, faster than normal speed, anywhere between 40 and 50 miles an hour on certain parts of the procession. And in fact, Tampa was the longest motorcade JFK ever had in the less than 3 years he was president. And yet he comes to Dallas, and the cars are going dreadfully slow, and even slower than that during the assassination itself. Usually he had multiple motorcycles running next to the limousine in a wedge formation, not only the quality of the formation itself being right beside JFK, but the quantity of motorcycles. Now, this actually happened up to and including the morning in November 22nd in Fort Worth. He gets to Dallas, and as the House Select Committee called it, it was a uniquely insecure situation because the motorcycles were stripped down from four on each side down to just two on each side. And to add insult to injury, they were moved further back behind the rear wheels. So basically, it was meaningless, the coverage. He was open to a crossfire, and they provided no coverage whatsoever. Okay. Now, this was a big discovery of mine in the last few years. It was basically right under my nose, and I didn't realize it until I looked at some newspaper archives and whatnot, that multi-story rooftops were guarded. This was not just a reaction to the tragedy beforehand, or, you know, the tragedy at the assassination. This happened for years, actually going back to the FDR, Truman, and Eisenhower era, let alone the early Kennedy era. And this stems from not only the protective survey report of the Secret Service that was released in the late 1990s in Tampa, and also personal interviews with several people involved in the protection of the president in Tampa. Again, that was the major stop before the Texas trip. But also, dredging the newspaper archives, I found that the multi-story roofs were guarded along President Kennedy's parades in Milwaukee, Paris, Nashville, Chicago. The list goes on. And obviously, that did not happen in Dallas. And for anybody out there that's in the minority that even displeased Oswald Agnew alone, well, if the roofs would have been guarded, at the very least, that would have prevented, they would have saw Oswald, if you displeased it was Oswald. Obviously, conspiracy with the, you know, the rooftops being guarded, it's that much better of a chance that they would have seen what was going on. In fact, when Kennedy came to Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, there was police with binoculars scanning the crowds. And oftentimes, they also were in the crowds themselves. Now, it was a combination of the police facing the crowd, the military facing the crowd, some branch of the military, usually the Marines, okay? And sometimes even the agents themselves were interspersed within the crowd. So that's why sometimes you cannot go by pictures and still, and even motion pictures to a point, because they only give you this small slice in time, and even still photo especially, because you cannot judge the speed and all the angles and whatnot. But even though the Secret Service had manpower issues, with being augmented by police and military and the local field offices of the Secret Service, they were able to adequately provide protection for the president. Now, finally, just a few more things. And I just mentioned about the police and military lining the streets, but it's not happening in Dallas. Okay. The overpasses are supposed to be clear of spectators. That did not happen in Dallas. Okay. The special agent in charge or his immediate assistant always accompanied the president when he left Washington, D.C. That's Jerry Bain or Floyd Bourne. He gets to Dallas, a third stringer, Roy Kellerman, is making his first major trip on his own without either Bain or Boring. And I always make the analogy for people. Imagine going to the Super Bowl and starting your third string quarterback. Dallas was a city that JFK was warned about by Senator Fulbright, Adlai Stevenson, and several other people. JFK even said, "We're heading to nut country." It's an exact quote. And yet the Secret Service ostensibly found no threats to the president, something that Roy Kellerman told the Warren Commission was very unusual, and other agents I spoke to thought that was unusual. Just common sense would dictate, because the rabid right-wing environment, the John Birch Society, Ku Klux Klan, the wanted for treason posters against JFK, and they find not one person had a threat or a grudge against the president. Hard to believe. And White House photographer Cecil Stoughton normally rode in the follow-up car, and he was there in Tampa taking photos. He was pushed further back in the motorcade, again by the Secret Service. Dr. Berkley, the president's personal physician, normally rode in a car very close by the president, either in the lead car in front or the follow-up car behind. He protested at Love Field. The Secret Service put him far away. And this is a real stunner, because I think this is another thing that's like the multi-story roofs that a lot of people aren't aware of. Normally, a flatbed truck of still-in-motion photographers, UPI, Associated Press, etc., were there in front of the presidential procession, as they were in Tampa and countless other parades, filming. And sometimes even a live feed went out to television stations. There's a video in San Diego in June of local affiliates. They were pulling all their resources, ABC, NBC, and CBS, and they were having live video footage, black and white, of the motorcade. He gets to Dallas and, again, canceled the last minute by the Secret Service. Tom Dillard told the Warren Commission, who was a Dallas Morning News photographer, they were very dismayed. All the press and photographers were pushed further back at the motorcade, which, quote, put them totally out of the picture. And all those things, whether they were security-related or just coverage-related with press and photographers, that was all Secret Service decisions. And here's the clincher of all. Not only did the Secret Service break these protocols, and a lot of these things were unique to Dallas, they ended up blaming President Kennedy for these things after the fact. And then I found out through my years of research contacting these gentlemen that this was not true, that the president had nothing to do with these things. He did not order the agents off the car. He did not order the motorcycles away from his own limousine. Obviously, well, I say obvious, but this is based on my research. He had nothing to do with the press photographers in the military aid being pushed away. These, again, were all Secret Service decisions. You know, to quote Harry Truman again, not only did he say the Secret Service is the only boss the president ever had, he also said the buck stops here. And when you look at the Secret Service, you know, the security and whatnot, the buck stops with them. You know, you normally had good intelligence on these trips. The Protective Research Section, they monitor potential threats to the president. It's now called the Intelligence Division, but basically, make a long story short, what they did is, whether it was just a low nut who sent in a threatening postcard or an organized plot or everything in between, the Secret Service would check that out. They would have the local field office and the local police check out a suspect, an individual, and make sure that person was monitored or even throw them in jail during the procession so the person was out of the way and wasn't a harm. And for the Secret Service reports that survived the shredder, as many Secret Service reports were destroyed in 1995 under the protests of the Assassination Records Review Board that were seeking them, the few that survived almost invariably have at least one threat individual listed. You know, someone who wished harm on the president, and he worked on the parade, so they had the person under surveillance or even in jail or in a mental hospital, some combination. And again, I can't stress this enough. Dallas was a city JFK was warned about, and supposedly there's no threats. Well, to add on to that, I found another one of my major discoveries was I found a covert monitor of the president's security. This was covered up afterwards, meaning specifically Protective Research Section agent Glenn Bennett was riding in the follow-up car. Now, he was normally an agent. Actually, he wasn't even a true agent in the true sense of the word. He was an administrative person, officer, that was stayed back in Washington. It was a desk job for people out there, you know, that want to spell it out. And what they did is they would go through, you know, postcards, filing cabinets, whatnot, and keep track of any potential threat around the country and around the world, whether the person lived in, you know, Washington State or California or Hawaii, whatever. They would do this. And through interviews and research, I found out that it was very unusual, to put it mildly, that a Protective Research Section agent would have been on the trip, found evidence from testimony that this was actually the first time a Protective Research Section agent did a technical advance on a presidential trip. Well, then it gets even deeper with Glenn Bennett. He was on the president's New York and Florida trips right before Dallas. He lied under oath to the House Select Committee and said he was not on the Florida trip. Now, keep in mind, this is just 15 years later. Everybody remembers where they were when Kennedy was shot. He was on all the major trips that Kennedy took in the month of November, and he was on all the stops in Florida, too. He was there in Cape Canaveral, Palm Beach, Miami, Tampa, riding in the follow-up car, yet he tells the House Select Committee under oath, "I was not dispatched to the president's Florida trip in November of 1963, He also did not volunteer. He was on the New York trip. Now, when you know, put that in the fact that, you know, Gerald Blaine of the Kennedy Detail and other agents told me, it was kind of strange for Glenn Bennett to have, you know, being in the follow-up car in Dallas. Well, I think it's a no-brainer that actually even although the cover story was they found no threats to the president's life in Dallas, I think covertly, they knew, they were much aware of moving threats to the president's life. There was a canceled motorcade in Chicago to start the month of November in 1963. They also knew about the Joseph Miltier threat, right-wing supremacist. He threatened the president's life in Miami on November 9th. Well, the next day, November 10th, is when Glenn Bennett was temporarily assigned to the White House detail. And it goes even deeper than that. Not only do you have that discovery, I call that one of the smoking guns of the Kennedy case, because that really strains credulity that it was one man, Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, and there was no conspiracy. When you have a covert monitor of threats plural, to the president's life, and this is not detail, this is not common knowledge, to put it mildly. You won't find this in the Warren Commission report, the Select Committee.
Vince,
yes.
I want to go into greater detail here, because from what you're telling us,
mm-hmm.
there were many former agents that you contacted and corresponded with.
Great.
share with us some of the more damning evidence that proves, at least beyond a reasonable doubt, that the JFK assassination was government orchestrated, and then, as specifically as you can be, okay, what influence did the CIA have with the Secret Service?
Okay, I'll give you both there. All right, specifically, there was basically six or eight agents that believe it was a conspiracy. One of the big ones was Jerry O'Rourke, who was on the Texas trip. He came out in 2003 for the 40th anniversary in an obscure Colorado newspaper, wasn't even one of the dailies, and espoused his belief that there was a conspiracy to take the president's life. And he said he knew he was in the minority of the agents. At least they won't admit it, but he says they were ordered to lie. And he said that the autopsy was a total cover-up, and that Ruby definitely shot Oswald to silence him. J. Edgar Hoover was in it up to his neck. Well, I spoke to the gentleman. I went further than just taking that article at face value. I spoke to him and corresponded with him. And and this is really apropos when I was talking about Glenn Bennett, because I brought up the Glenn Bennett situation. And he was a real friendly guy, again, pro-conspiracy. The moment I mentioned Glenn Bennett's name, his tone changes. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. I'm afraid for my agency. And he hung up on me. And a couple weeks later, he, the Blue, emailed me and basically apologized and changed the subject, but was willing to take more questions from me. I think that was very telling, to put it mildly, that I struck a nerve when I mentioned Glenn Bennett. And again, this is an agent that was pro-conspiracy, did not believe Oswald acted alone. There's other ones, too. Other agents, Maurice Martineau, Abraham Bolden, Sam Kinney, the driver of the follow-up car. Sam Kinney saw the back of the president's head blow off during the shooting. What that means for the audience is entrance holes are small. Exit holes are large. So if Sam Kinney, and he joined the chorus of people in Dallas and at Bethesda, that saw the right rear of the president's head missing, that's prima facie evidence for conspiracy right there in a shot from the front. Now, as far as the CIA itself, the connection, this is really amazing here. Two agents, Roger Warner and James Mastrovito, both went on to lengthy careers in the CIA not long after Dallas. Roger Warner, along with Winston Lawson, was in charge of the motorcade order of vehicles. He was the one who actually put the numbers in the cars and put the order. And obviously he's one of my prime suspects for what was stripped away from Kennedy, meaning the flatbed truck and, you know, the motorcycles, et cetera, et cetera. It's all spelled out in my book. Well, again, he left the Secret Service a few years later and had a lengthy career in the CIA. It's even worse for James Mastrovito. He was not only Kennedy's White House detail to join the Secret Service or join the CIA, but in the 1970s, he was in charge of the Secret Service files on the Kennedy assassination. And to the ARRB, the investigation in the 90s, uncovering all the files, he told them, matter-of-factly, that he had a small part of the president's brain in all the files. He ended up destroying most of them. The guy didn't get in any kind of legal trouble. There's no investigation. It's just, he just matter-of-factly tells them this, and that's it. It's just like the Secret Service shredding documents in 1995. Oh, yeah, there was a little bit of raised eyebrows and, you know, a little ire behind the scene. They were mad, Judge Thunheim of the ARB and so forth, but nothing happened. No legal repercussions. Really wasn't a big deal in the media. This is outrageous. Judge Thunheim was even on television last night reminiscing, and he said of all the agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the, you know, National Security Agency, et cetera, only the Secret Service destroyed records, and they were the toughest agency to deal with. And now when you harken back to, like I said, those two agents I know for a fact went on to CIA careers, and the suspicion that draws on them. Yeah, Roger Warner, by the way, that was his first presidential trip, was Dallas. He's in charge of the motorcade order of vehicles. Very suspicious, to put it mildly. But I think the biggest surprise in a general way would be, I think most people out there would think that these gentlemen would toe the line. They would think that, oh, Oswald acted alone, there's nothing to this. But again, a lot of things are compartmentalized, that not only did about six or eight agents right off the top of my head believe there was a conspiracy, some of them espoused views that went against official history and didn't realize the repercussions of that. Like Paul Landis on the follow-up car, on one hand, believes Oswald acted alone, yet in his two reports submitted to the Warren Commission, he said that one of the shots came from the front. I mean, that's ludicrous. He doesn't realize that, you know, what that means. It's like Clint Hill, you know, his report to the Warren Commission and his testimony, he talks matter-of-factly, just like Sam Kinney, the right rear of the president's head was gone, the wound was far on the back of the president, not on the back of the neck. Obviously, that goes against official history and screams cover-up and conspiracy, but the gentleman goes on TV and is satisfied that Oswald had it alone, satisfied there was only three shots. Reminds me of Governor Connally, never believed in single bullet theory, yet at the same time said Oswald had it alone. I see, again, I think that a lot of these government officials and whatnot have a mental block, and they don't realize the weight and the meaning behind some of the statements they made. And that's why I contacted a lot of these gentlemen, because not only did I find a lot of things in the security protocol that was very suspicious. I mean, to put it in layman's terms, Kennedy was a sitting duck when he comes to Dallas. There's no other way to put it. That's, I mean, vernacular, but it's the truth. And that's not even Monday morning quarterbacking, and that is not looking at the Secret Service through 2013 glasses. We're talking strictly from protocols from, you know, decades before 1963, but even just for the few short days, weeks, and months before the Dallas trip. When you look, it takes an effort to do this, and a lot of the stuff was before the Internet. You know, these records only came out in the late 1990s when they did come out, so it took a lot of effort, and to contact these gentlemen to get anything out of them was difficult as well.
Vince, I want to continue on. Where there are members of the Secret Service who immediately believed that something was not correct and felt there may have been an inside federal agency effort to kill Kennedy.
Yes. Maurice Martineau. And this gentleman was a veteran of the Secret Service. He was around since at least the FDR days. Maurice Martineau was the special agent in charge of the Chicago office, and he was also a White House detail agent before that. He told me that he was definitely convinced that there was a conspiracy that took the president's life, and that was not just based on his reading or anything after the fact. He wouldn't go into any details with me other than to say that I knew right away, as soon as I heard the shooting sequence and what had allegedly happened. And I said, sir, can you please tell me more about this? And this was back in 1993 when I spoke to him. He said, well, I have some ideas. And it was real long, drawn-out pauses. And he said, well, without actually going into the particulars, I really don't want to share them with a stranger, so I think I'll keep them to myself. So it was really shocking. This gentleman was very well known in the Secret Service, and he was Abraham Bolden's boss. Abraham Bolden was the first African-American agent of the Secret Service who was later framed for what happened afterwards. He wanted to go to the Warren Commission and also espouse his views on the bad security that was afforded President Kennedy and his belief that the assassination could have been prevented. And Maurice Martineau was his boss. And, on, you know, Abraham Bolden says in his book that when the office, the Chicago office, got the news that Kennedy was shot, Maurice Martineau's attitude was, well, what else is new? So even though he had all these views later on that something was amiss, that day his behavior was very nonchalant. He wasn't shocked. He was acting like, so what? It was almost like he knew something was going to happen. In fact, and again, this is a chapter in my book, Chapter 17, where I go into the Chicago trip where it was canceled due to threats, plural, threats to the president's life. They knew about, there was these two gentlemen, Homer Echevarria and Tom Mosley, and they were Cuban exiles that had connection with the CIA. Well, so Secret Service headquarters told the Chicago office to stop their investigation and to return all notebooks and files on the Echevarria-Mosley case and not to discuss the case with anyone. Not only does that come from Abraham Bolden, that comes from Joseph Noonan. Joseph Noonan was a Chicago office agent, also a former Kennedy detail agent, and this is what he told the High Select Committee, matter-of-factly, in the late 70s. But again, I can't stress this enough. This is not common knowledge because those documents only came out in the late 1990s, and it's only available to researchers that want to dig. Even when they did come out, there was no fanfare on the individual specifications of the documents that were released. It took authors and researchers to, you know, to put two and two together and to figure out, you know, what the meaning was behind these millions of pages that were coming out. But definitely when speaking to these gentlemen, I also uncovered some other things as far as, you know, the shooting sequence and whatnot. Again, Sam Kinney, he never spoke to the Warren Commission. When he did speak to the High Select Committee, his interview was buried until 1999. And I spoke to him back in the early 90s. And again, he espoused the view that there was no missed shot He did not believe it was a missed shot. He said he saw all three shots hit, and that's what he said, the back of the head of the president was gone. And again, you know, the official history was that shot only came from the rear and made a small entrance hole in the back of the president's head. So just amazing, you know, when you actually speak to these guys, you know.
Vince, what else was unnatural or unusual about how the motorcade was organized with respect to other individuals accompanying the president in Dallas?
Well, the sheriff's department and police normally assist, you know, the procession in good number. The sheriff's department was told by the sheriff, Bill Decker, to stand down that day to in no way participate in the security of the motorcade. They were to be spectators and nothing more. The military intelligence was told to stand down, although there were some individual members of military intelligence in Dallas. They were there on their own time, so to speak, James Powell being one of them. The day before in San Antonio, again, it's a theme that runs through my research. These things only came out in the late 1990s. The day before in San Antonio, there was 40 members of the 112th Military Intelligence Unit augmenting the trip. There was a police helicopter used on the route. And now it didn't happen all the time, but I found several instances where there was a helicopter monitoring the route. Needless to say, these things did not happen in Dallas. Okay, so and then as far as the order of the vehicles, without that flatbed truck in front of the presidential limousine, we just had to rely on amateurs, rank amateurs out there in the plaza. Thank God for Abraham Zapruder had taken the definitive film, and even to this day, people think the film's altered. But I mean, there would have been many professional eyewitnesses and still in motion pictures, and that was, you know, stripped away. And with the motorcycle formation being stripped away to a measly few riders and away from the car, that opened up Kennedy to crossfire and conspiracy. And that was a traditional wedge formation is what he received. Many motorcycles surrounding the car in a diamond, and that was stripped away from him. And again, that was blamed on Kennedy. Supposedly he didn't like that because he wanted to have conversation in the car. And this is total bunk. Winston Lawson even admitted to the Warren Commission that not specifically on this trip was there an order from him. And then he kind of extrapolated and said, well, you know, it's my understanding that he didn't like a lot of motorcycles around his car. I don't know what he's talking about because when you look at films and photos of previous trips, including just in the Texas trip alone, he had that wedge formation of many motorcycles surrounding the car. And the whole thing about blaming the president for the agents being away from the car, this is total bunk. I spoke to many of former agents, including members of the brass, the number one agent, Jerry Baines, the number two agent, Floyd Boring, one of the shift leaders, Art Godfrey, the list goes on, and they all told me President Kennedy was a very nice man, never interfered with their actions, and did not order them off the car. But this was years later. They were retired. They didn't realize, you know, the weight and gravity of what they're telling me. There's an old saying, it's easier to remember the truth than the lie. And I think, you know, back if I would have spoken to these gentlemen back in late 1963 to early 65, if they were able to talk to me to begin with, they probably would have espoused the line that, yeah, the president didn't want us there. But, you know, all these years went by.
Okay,
and the real story.
But now you're speculating. You shouldn't go back and speculate to what they may have done because you don't have that evidence. All you have is the evidence they shared with you, and let's stick with only facts, not speculation, because then you undermine your own credibility, all right?
Okay.
Then you become just another conspiratorial theorist, and you've done too much homework, too much scholarship, too much good quality researching to veer off that road.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's fair enough. It's,
okay.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
Now, you've told us today that the Secret Service had multiple knowledges in Chicago, for example, that Kennedy's life was at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And what were these threats beyond what you've told us go into greater depth? And wouldn't that alone have been enough to have increased rather than decreased the security for any future city?
Yes, Gary, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly right. There's these multiple threats to the president right before Dallas. If anything, security and intelligence should have been increased. Instead, it was decreased. I mentioned this gentleman before, Tom Mosley and Homer Echevarria. It was also a 14, it was either Cuban or Puerto Rican hit squad, And this came out in former Agent McNally's obscure book, A Million Miles of Presidents. It was only released, his widow released it in 1982. It was basically a photocopied book. And in it, he talks about in March of 1963, when the president traveled to Chicago, we got word of a Puerto Rican sniper team. Helicopters monitored the buildings during the parade, and luckily, nothing came of this. I'm thinking, whoa, that is amazing, because that is not in any, you know, book over the counter. It's only just because this gentleman, you know, passed away many years ago. His widow made photocopies of his manuscript, and it was available in a very limited number. And this came out. Abraham Bolden, in his book, former agent, again, first African-American agent of the White House detail, well, he came out and corroborated this four-man hit team. Again, it's not clear whether it was Cuban or Puerto Rican. The bottom line is it was a threat of multiple men against the president shortly before the assassination, not Lee Harvey Oswald. And again, we're asked to believe that Oswald acted alone when the Secret Service was much aware of mortal threats to the president's life. He gets to Florida, and I got this from many agents I spoke to. They were very concerned about Miami and Tampa. There were 6 pages in the protective research files of threats to the president's life. Enrique Laca, Pedro Diaz Lanz, a whole bunch of other anti-Castro Cubans that made threats against the president's life. That's part of the reason why, for the majority of the Miami leg of the Florida trip, JFK went by helicopter. And as far as, you know, the brunt of that trip, the security was fantastic. Again, when I, you know, made that list before, it's because they were much aware of what was happening. I mean, the chief of police spoke to Lamar Waldron in Ultimate Sacrifice and even said how concerned they were about the president's life in Florida. And everybody knows, well, I should say everybody, a lot of researchers know about that Joseph Miltier gentleman I mentioned earlier, who's on the Men That Killed Kennedy, the audio of his actually speaking to an undercover informant about, oh, it's in the works. They're going to shoot him from an office building with a high-powered rifle. They'll pick up somebody afterwards just to throw the public off. I spoke to Robert Bauck, who was the special agent in charge of PRS. He told me, oh, yeah, he was aware of that before the president's assassination, and, you know, there was no mystery to this. And I'm thinking, okay, if he knew about this, again, why didn't, you know, more security, more intelligence, you know, he drew a blank. He wouldn't, you know, dealing with gentlemen was sometimes, you know, it was tough because, you know, I was trying to be friendly, I was trying to be nice, but, you know, I was asking the hardball questions sometimes, and sometimes they would give and sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they wouldn't realize the weight of what they were telling me. But the bottom line is you had a canceled trip in Chicago, November 1st, 1963, due to these mortal threats to the president. November 18th, you had multiple threats to the president's life in Miami and Tampa, page after page of anti-Castro Cubans. Sam Kinney told me they had an organized crime scare, a threat done in Tampa. And again, that's corroboration for all the researchers to believe, you know, like Santa Traficante of Florida and other mafia dons had a vendetta against Kennedy. Again, we're asked to believe come November 22nd that all these forces just, you know, stepped aside and a low nut took Kennedy out. There's nothing to this. When the Secret Service knew this was a moving threat, and yet he comes to Dallas, and it not only was the security stripped, but unbelievably, Roy Kellerman, that night at the autopsy, told the FBI agents that the security measures invoked for the president's trip to Dallas were the most stringent and thorough ever in the history of the Secret Service, the protection of the president. Not only is that an obscene and wrong statement, well, then later on, when he was called on the carpet on that, months later, he denied he said it to the FBI. But the two FBI agents swore that's exactly what he said. I mean, the details of what he said that night, it's even Bill Greer, his partner in the limousine. Bill Greer said that sometimes we were asked by the president to slow down, again, the blame the victim mantra, because they knew they were in trouble. They knew the Secret Service, at the very least, could lose their protective functions, or maybe the whole agency would collapse. J. Edgar Hoover, like Truman said, was chomping at the bit to take over, that, you know, since the late 1940s, Hoover had his sights on the Secret Service, would have loved to have been the president's bodyguards and also, you know, to get more blackmail information on the president. So you had that, you know, you had the agencies themselves, the FBI, the CIA, the Secret Service, the, you know, defense, intelligence, all being at war with each other. Instead of cooperating, they were all jealous, envious, trying to take sides, trying to get the better of each other. So you had this non-cooperative situation, too, the FBI Secret Service feuding really stands out, because if there would have been better intelligence and intelligence sharing, some of these threats might have got through.
Vince, yeah. Something that no one in this audience was aware of, mm-hmm. and very few scholars are aware of, and that was the mysterious death of a Secret Service agent a month prior to the assassination. And this agent may have been Kennedy's designated driver for Dallas.
Yes.
Share what you've uncovered.
Okay. Again, this is one of my discoveries. No one ever knew about this gentleman. His name, by Thomas B. Shipman, was one of the drivers of the president's cars. He was a protective agent like all the rest, gun-carrying protective agent, but one of his duties was also to drive the president. October 14th, 1963, he dies of an alleged heart attack at Camp David. I wanted to get more corroboration because I was floored by that. I had never read that anywhere. Never saw that in an article, book, anything. So I started to look, and I came up with nothing at first. No, nothing on Thomas B. Shipman. I did internet searches, Ancestry.com, the list goes on. Nothing, nada. So I started to recontact some of the agents again, and Sam Kinney told me, I found the body up at Camp David, and he was like hemming and hawing, and you could tell I struck a nerve, because this is in the history of the Secret Service from 1865 to the present. They've had thousands of agents. Only 34 have died in the line of duty, and that includes the five that died in the Oklahoma City bombing, agents in 1901 that were run over by a streetcar. I mean, we're talking about a very, very small percentage of agents. And an agent dies the month before at Camp David of an alleged heart attack. These fit gentlemen, these men are fit as a fiddle. I mean, they don't just hire these guys off the street. They have to pass physical tests, mental tests, extensive background checks. I mean, this is not, some people have views of law enforcement today, but the Secret Service has always been fit, trim, and they pass rigorous tests and whatnot, and he's fine at Camp David. And what that really is incredible is the fact that he could have and should have been the agent that drove Kennedy in Dallas. The agent that did, Bill Greer, was very inept, terrible what he did. He slowed the vehicle down. He looked back at Kennedy twice. He disobeyed Roy Kellerman's order to get out of line. He denied all this to the Warren Commission, too. But the thing about Shipman was, I must have struck a nerve, because at first there was nothing about Thomas Shipman online, nothing whatsoever. Then lo and behold, 10 years ago, the former Agents Association posted a roll call of officers that passed in the line of duty. For the first time, Thomas Shipman's name appears, and it's there to this day. Anybody can check it out. And it just talks about how he died at Camp David, nothing more, nothing less.
All right, this is merely an open question, because just as legitimately, he may have had a heart attack. Young people do have heart attacks. Military personnel have heart attacks. People in combat and special forces have heart attacks. Mm-hmm. So it would not be an anomaly of so unique nature as to warrant then speculating that there would have been some reason to have had him taken out as a driver. And we have to put that in that context that it is. Now, to another issue, you've reviewed black and white videos, which have never been entered into the Warren Commission evidence, that witnessed abnormal activities in Secret Service agents' behavior. Tell us about that.
Okay. Yeah. Back in 1991, going through hours and hours of WFAA ABC video, WFAA being the Dallas-Fort Worth affiliate of ABC, I saw the Love Field departure, and now this video is pretty common, but keep in mind, back in 1991, no one knew about this until I discovered it. And lo and behold, it shows the procession moving out, the presidential limousine, and the follow-up car. And then all of a sudden, you see an agent that was jogging beside the president's car, Don Lawton, stop and raise his hands, not once, not twice, but three times in disgust, as Emory Roberts, the agent in the follow-up car, rises in his seat and with hand gestures, and obviously he's speaking, the video has no sound, obviously tells him to cease and desist. One of the agents, Paul Landis, makes room for Don Lawton on the follow-up car. He actually goes back into the follow-up car from the running board on the outside, and Don Lawton stays at Love Field. Well, I found out there was actually two agents that were recalled at Love Field. Henry Ripka, he was there originally jogging beside the car right out of camera view, although there was some newsreel pictures that picked him up. Don Lawton took over for him in short order, and Don Lawton is the agent that is famously recalled in the WFAA ABC video. And that right there, picture tells us 1,000 words. And anyone who ever saw that initially, I showed that in conferences in the 90s and later on the History Channel and whatnot, and said, that's unbelievable. I've never seen that before. What is it? What kind of explanation the Secret Service has? Here's a gentleman that's doing his job, jogging beside the car as the procession leaves. And here is the special agent in charge of the FOB car, Emory Roberts, telling him to cease and desist. Emory Roberts would later recall an agent, John Reddy, when the shooting begins. Sam Kinney, the driver of the FOB car, told me, Emory, yes, he did order the agents not to move when the shooting began. But then he kind of backed her and said, well, I'm proud of Emory. Exactly right. He did that because of the speed of the cars, and, you know, he was afraid these agents would, you know, they would get hurt by, you know, being thrown under the wheels of a limousine. What makes no sense about that is they were only going 11.2 miles an hour. They were only 5 feet away. Their job is to protect the president. They should have been running after that limousine. They should have been on the limousine or near the limousine anyway. But when you see this video at Love Field, it really, again, it's one thing to talk about these things and talk about Dawkins. When you see that video footage, it's very powerful, and that's the way it struck a lot of people through the years, because it's incredible. I mean, there's no other, you know, the Secret Service in 2010, a few years ago, Clint Hill was on C-SPAN, and he claimed, this is ludicrous, he claimed the agent was saying, I'm going to lunch, have a nice trip. And to say that that went over like a lead balloon is put bluntly, because many researchers castigated Mr. Hill for that. When you try to sync that up with the actions on the video, then they don't add up at all. I mean, he raises his hands not once, not twice, but three times. And again, that agent makes room for him, and he doesn't budge. And that just looms large for what did and did not happen in Dallas security-wise.
Hon, I want to thank you. Let us now say goodbye to one guest and say hello to another who is standing by. By the way, if you've just tuned in, and people do throughout the hour, this is a special in-depth original investigative report, a 7-part series on the JFK assassination, and you've been listening to Vince Palmera, P-A-L-A-M-A-R-A. Now let's go to St. John Hunt, the son of the high-ranking CIA spy and Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt. Nice to have you with us today, Saint.
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me?
Sure can. You're on
Skype.
Great.
We have a good connection.
All right. I'd like to begin by first just having you tell the audience about your father, a short list of the government intelligence activities he participated in that are noteworthy. Of course, he's best known for Watergate, but people have no idea that he had any knowledge about the JFK assassination. And then your father jotted down a short flow chart identifying the chain of command, as it were, that orchestrated what the JFK conspirators called the big event. At the top of the chart was Lyndon Johnson, followed by CIA official Cord Meyer, who was the ex-husband of JFK's mistress at the time of the assassination. Then underneath Meyer were two names, David Morales and Bill Harvey. And finally, under Morales, it reads, French gunman Grassy Knoll. Now, I'd like for you to go into depth about the role that your father said that that Johnson played in Kennedy's assassination, but that'll come second after we know more about your father.
Well, thank you, Gary, very much, first of all, for having me on your show. And secondly, I'd like to thank all your listeners, all the supporters of continuing to fight for the truth. And so let's get right to who exactly E. Howard Hunt was. He was a career political action officer for the CIA. He started, in fact, before the CIA became the CIA. It originally was the Office of Strategic Services, just post-World War II, towards the very last year of World War II, and then the OSS changed into the CIA with its own special mandates and rules and regulations. He is most notably came to note as a CIA operative when, in, I believe, 1957, he was the mastermind, a brilliant tactician and a psychological warfare operative for the overthrow of the Guatemalan regime. And he achieved this almost single-handedly with tape loops and pre-recorded sounds on tapes of B-52 bombers flying overhead, machine gun fire in the background, the sound of large crowds marching through city streets. And he did this all by cutting into their radio channels and broadcasting this. Well, the government in Guatemala was so terrified that they basically surrendered, and they did have some ragtag Guatemalan revolutionaries there at the time, but the CIA was stunned at the ease of which this operation had gone down. Secondly, they put him in charge of the Bay of Pigs invasion. They put him in charge of handpicking the next president of Cuba once Fidel Castro had been assassinated. My father was the first CIA officer to lay out in no uncertain terms that the successful overthrow of Cuba was going to have to be accomplished along with the killing of Fidel Castro. Well, we all know that that didn't go so well. There was, that's a whole topic in itself. Later on, my father was hired by President Nixon's White House to be part of their Special Investigations Unit, which was nicknamed the Plumbers. And their job was to find out where the leaks were coming from, that information about the Vietnam War and how it was really an unwinnable war were coming out of the Defense Department and into the hands of the New York Times. Thusly, they called it the Plumbers. They were plugging the leaks. Along that capacity in the White House, my father was chief of operations during the several Watergate break-ins. There was two, in fact, and many other illegal and clandestine operations for Richard Nixon's White House, some of which are almost theatrical in nature. The renting of houseboats in Miami and the hiring of prostitutes down here, I'm in Florida myself, for on-camera two-way mirror recording for blackmail purposes of any Democratic convention men. And he was also sent to Milwaukee to break in the apartment of Arthur Bremer to plant pro-McGovern literature in his apartment. Was sent up to Massachusetts, Chappaquiddick, most notably to put the nail in the coffin of Teddy Kennedy. My dad was a well-known Kennedy hater after he lost so many of his friends and comrades at the Bay of Pigs. And then it became known during Watergate when he was arrested there. Spent 4.5 years in federal prison, and it was during this time that his picture started emerging, and I think one of the earliest persons to link my father to the JFK assassination was, in fact, a stand-up comedian named Dick Gregory. So then the story unfolds. My dad spent the next 20 years of his life fighting accusations and allegations about whether he was involved in JFK's murder. Yes, he was, or no, he wasn't. Called before two Senate inquiries, the Church Committee and the Rockefeller Commission, involved in illegal assassination and other dirty tricks by the CIA. And, of course, he denied any involvement in killing Kennedy and said he didn't know anybody that was involved. It was a CIA operation, either on or off the shelf. So that's who my dad was.
Okay, now let's go to the more important issue. When your father was in Danbury Prison for Watergate crime, Frank Sturgis, who was also one of the Watergate burglars, was in prison with him. And Sturgis was an intelligence operative, part of Operation 40, and had close Cuban connections, and told your father the shooter was a foreigner. Tell us a bit more about Sturgis and his role in the JFK assassination, since he was dealing closely with Morales and Harvey. And then what light can be shed on who the French gunman was on the grassy knoll? Tell us about the French criminal connection with the CIA. And then also on your father's deathbed, the chart, the confession. Let's start there. We don't have a lot of time, so I'd like you to go right to the important points.
All right. Frank Sturgis and my father met in the late 50s when they were gearing up for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Frank Sturgis fought alongside of Fidel Castro in the Sierra Maestra Mountains. And then when Castro started leaning towards communism, Sturgis fled to this country and became a contract officer for the CIA. So he wasn't really on paper, but my dad and Frank had a very close relationship for many, many, many years. And my father told me that Frank was not cruelly meaning, but he said Frank was a loyal dog. You could put a rifle in Frank's hand, you could point him at somebody and say, shoot that SOB, and Frank would kill him. This is the kind of man Frank Sturgis was. Now, he worked alongside another CIA contract officer, a killer, really, named David Sanchez Morales. And he was a Latin American, non-Cuban. I think he was Mexican. But in any event, David Morales and Frank Sturgis were very closely linked through this Operation 40 that you mentioned. It was also known as Executive Action. This was run by a CIA officer. He was chief of the station in Rome after RFK demoted him and sent him over to Rome to get him out of this country. He was causing too many problems. At this point, RFK and JFK were trying to negotiate with Russia the peaceful settlement of missiles in Cuba, and they did not want renegade CIA operatives to be running raids against Cuban sugarcane fields or radio towers. And Bill Harvey was the kind of guy that would do this. He was a heavy drinker who carried two pistols at his sides, and he ran the executive action arm of the CIA, and had hired David Morales, and Frank Sturgis worked along with him too. So, and even earlier in that, in this 1959, Bill Harvey was head of the false defector program for false defection to Russia. In other words, he would recruit soldiers, privates, or whatnot, from the Marines or the Navy, and so forth, and then send them over to Russia in this false defector program. Now, it is a fact that Lee Harvey Oswald defected to Russia in 1959, and it's probably going to come out, if it hasn't already, that he was part of this false defector program. Lee Harvey Oswald is not the dumb patsy that a lot of people think he was. He was very, very smart guy, and spoke fluent Russian. But go back to Morales.
St. John, sir. I need a little clarity here, so I'm going to ask you some short answers, if you would, please.
Okay.
All right, because it's interesting, the cast of characters, but we need some just basic facts. So if you could address these very briefly. Was your father involved directly or indirectly in the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Yes, he was. He was involved. You can't be involved indirectly. I mean, he was involved directly in the planning of one of the assassination teams against John F. Kennedy.
How many assassination teams were there?
As far as he knew, after a few meetings with Harvey, Morales, and Sanchez at safe houses in and around Miami, Florida, that there was at least two teams. But knowing the CIA, there could have been more.
All right. There has always been the controversy over whether or not your father was in Dallas on November 22nd. Some JFK researchers believe that your dad was identified as one of the so-called three tramps found in a boxcar on the railroad tracks that were close to Daly Plaza, although the official record claims they were in fact hobos. Subsequent testimony from some of them later reveals one was an intelligence operative and the other two were convicted murderers, including the absent father of actor Woody Harrelson, who, by the way, for the audience, later confessed that he was one of the JFK shooters by his own words, but he was ignored. So what can you tell us about the whereabouts of your dad immediately before, during, and after the assassination?
Well, first of all, it has been determined that my father was in Dallas the evening before the assassination, and very quite possibly on the day of the assassination. Now, we know this from several sources. Number one, I was at home at the time, and my mother mentioned to me that Papa was on a business trip in Dallas. And secondly, we have my father's first alibi that he was at work at Langley and in the CIA complex there. After those records had been subpoenaed, it had been determined that, in fact, he was on a 32-hour leave of absence. So that blew his first alibi. Then he said he wasn't feeling well and he was at home with his children. And he had written me a letter saying if anybody were to ask me, any governmental person, if I was ever to testify in a court of law, to please remember that he was with me and my two sisters the day that Kennedy was killed. Well, I personally do not have any memory of seeing my father that day. I know where I was, and I don't know where he was.
Okay, that's good. But did your father tell us that Lyndon Johnson was the key architect behind the assassination?
Well, he said Johnson was the man that was ultimately responsible for the assassination of President Kennedy, not in the sense of a mastermind sitting down at a planning table orchestrating who's going to shoot from who. That was more of my dad's job. My dad was in Dealey Plaza as, well, he called himself a bench warmer, but in reality he was there to oversee the successful conclusion of this operation by doing everything he could to keep it organizationally tight.
Was your dad responsible for making sure that the people who participated under his control were later killed to keep them from talking?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't think that. Well, because Frank Sturgis lived for many, many years, and David Morales lived for at least a decade or so after that.
How many shooters were there?
Well, there was the one shooter that my father said in his told me and wrote down in the handwritten notes, a French Corsican gunman, and he said it was a name that he remembered roughly as Sarté or Sarté. My father's never read literature about any of this stuff, so this came directly from his own memory. And as we all know, there was a Corsican gunman that was part of Bill Harvey's executive action. It could have been codenamed QJ Wynn. It was probably Lucien Sarté, who was murdered in Mexico City a few years later.
Was John Connolly a part of, was he aware of there was an assassination attempt, or was he simply a victim himself?
This is only my opinion because my father never spoke to me about John Connolly, but I would surmise that he was just a victim. Right. I don't think anybody is going to willingly put themselves in a car knowing that there's an assassination going on.
Was a CIA official Cord Meyer part of the assassination?
Yes, he was. Cord Meyer was the link between LBJ and David Morales. In other words, the chain of command goes up from Sanchez, Morales, Frank Sturgis, their superior at the meetings were Bill Harvey. Bill Harvey said he was brought into this by Cord Meyer, and Cord Meyer would have had absolute direct link to LBJ, according to my father.
And what about J. Edgar Hoover?
J. Edgar Hoover played a very important role in this. Certainly he and Johnson had been very close pals and spent much time together. Hoover, of course, FBI had to do the investigating, and Hoover was the one, in fact, that forced John F. Kennedy to put Lyndon Johnson on his ticket in 1960. So Hoover was an extremely important element to the cover-up of the assassination.
All right. And who else did your father say was involved in the assassination?
Well, besides Cord Meyer, David Morales, Bill Harvey, there was David Atlee Phillips, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's handler, a longtime friend and fellow CIA officer with my father, worked in on the Bay of Pigs project with my dad, and as it turned out, been named by several witnesses as being in Mexico City with Lee Harvey Oswald, while Oswald was part of another false defection process to try to get to Cuba. He was sheep-dipped. Oswald was being sheep-dipped. over and over again as a pro-Castro, pro-Russian sympathizer. This was a common practice in CIA. This is my father told me this.
Final question. Before he died, did your father show any remorse or contrition, or did he believe that him being the technical expert to organize the assassination of John F. Kennedy was necessary based upon his political or ideological beliefs?
My father showed absolutely no remorse for his role in the JFK assassination. He, in fact, was proud of it in the sense that the deed was done and it was carried off fairly smoothly. The aftermath of it, of course, got messy for a lot of people. However, my father had a personal vendetta, a revenge. To him, this was a revenge killing as well as a political necessity, because it was felt that John Kennedy was too left-wing leaning and was going to bring the country to the downfall of, against communism. They're going to, fold under communist pressure.
One follow-up question, because we're out of time. Did your father ever mention that he could count upon the media not to probe this, that no major media would ever go further than the official explanations, the Warren Commission, etc.?
I think he assumed that. I think it was natural for him to make that assumption. I don't think until his... until his picture was splashed all over the newspapers of the world for Watergate, E. Howard Hunt was a name that that nobody knew. I mean, he was a successful.
Well, someone in some person in a responsible position within the assassination group decided an awful lot of people had to be killed. And but you say that your father never divulged that to you, so that he may or may not have been behind that. But now we have the names, we have the cast of characters, we have the motive, we have the where-it-all. They had to have someone at the top of the Secret Service, the FBI, the CIA. Well, we know they had one of the top people in the CIA, Cord Meyer. He was there before the CIA was formed. He was one of the top people and one of those East Coast establishment people. He had all the connection. David Morales, Bill Harvey, Lyndon Johnson. Now you've filled in the name of the French gunman on the grassy knoll. We know that there were three shooters. You're telling us your dad actually had two teams in operation based on the CIA's modus operandi, and probably one was ready in Chicago or Miami, the ones that were thwarted. There were two that were thwarted, but they nailed it in Dallas. And so you've put some pieces of the puzzle together we did not know before. I thank you very much, St. John Hunt, for coming on and sharing your insights with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me, Gary.
And his book is Bond of Secrecy, My Life with CIA Spy and Watergate Conspirator E. Howard Hunt. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.